Good morning. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 9.5 minutes past 7 o'clock on this Tuesday, April the 8th. We will talk this hour with New York Times reporter Eric Lichtblau, who broke the story about the NSA's, the National Security Agency's, warrantless wiretapping program. Remember that? He won the 2006 Pulitzer Prize for his stories on that warrantless wiretapping program, and Eric is in Madison today to talk about the public's right to know about things like this, about the spying that was taking place, about why the New York Times decided to delay publication of the story for more than a year after intense lobbying from the White House, and why the New York Times finally printed the story, which told us that the NSA was wiretapping phone calls between suspected terrorists abroad and people in this country without getting a court order to do so first, or even after the fact. We wonder if the publication of this story threatened national security. Did it dry up a source of intelligence unnecessarily? Or should we have known that this was taking place? We will welcome your thoughts and questions for our guest at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. In Madison, 263-1890. Or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Eric Lichtblau received the 2006 Pulitzer Prize for National Reporting for his stories on the NSA's wiretapping program. He has worked in the Washington Bureau of the New York Times covering the Justice Department and national security issues since 2002, and he is also the author of the new book, Bush's Law, The Remaking of American Justice. And Eric will be giving a talk this afternoon at 2:30 on the UW-Madison campus at the Pyle Center. The topic of his talk is, how much does the public really need to know? And he joins us by telephone. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Thanks a lot for being here. So, how much does the public really need to know?
Well, it depends who you ask. This is an administration that has really forced that question to the forefront, and we're living in an era after 9/11 where we've had to confront that question more than ever. I think the answer has shifted. After 9/11, I think the media was willing to accept a much lower standard, really, for what the public really needed to know. The White House put a premium on national security and secrecy. I get into that a lot in my book, Bush's Law. The secrecy was driven by Vice President Cheney's office, and there was a veil of secrecy on everything, including the NSA program, to the extent that even people that within the government who needed to know about the NSA program did not know about it, and that created really havoc within the administration, as I lay out in the book. Mm-hmm. And you can imagine the ripple effect when members in the public are brought into the equation. The media, I think, sort of bought into that for the first few years after 9/11 because we were going through such a historic period, living through such a cataclysmic event. And I think it was only really around 2004 that I place it that the recalibration started to take place. That the media really started to assume its old watchdog role, to get our old skepticism back, and to say, aren't these matters for public debate? Interrogation tactics and torture, surveillance tactics, basically how the war on terror was being prosecuted.
Well, there was a debate on this going on right at your newspaper, right?
There was, absolutely, yeah. That was kind of a microcosm for all this. We had started reporting on the NSA wiretapping story in 2004, in the spring of 2004, and had a story ready to go in October of 2004, and the White House urged us quite strongly not to run that story on the grounds of national security, that it would compromise what the White House saw as a vital program, and the editors, after a very difficult decision, concluded that the story would not run, and it was another 13 months or so before the story was published.
Yeah, and it was published in part because you said you'd publish it in your own book?
Not in my book, but in my partner's book. Mm-hmm. Jim Risen was my partner on the story, and he was doing a book at that time in 2005 on intelligence issues. And we were all in difficult, kind of uncharted territory here, and Jim felt that this was an important story that should run. I felt that it was a story that should run, but you know, we're the reporters. We don't make those decisions. Mm-hmm. The top editors in a story like this, the publisher makes that decision. Jim, after some agonizing of his own, did consider putting it in his book, and at that point, the paper did revisit this whole issue, and we went back and did more reporting. And a lot of the concerns that we had become aware of a year earlier about the program, particularly about the legal foundations of the program and the internal dissent that it caused, became even clearer. And the paper felt more comfortable running the story at that point in late 2005. And of course, we've now had we're now in April 2008. We've now had 2.5 years of ongoing debate. This is an issue that will not and has not died. Congress is still debating this today.
Yeah, in fact, I can't remember right now. It's sort of it's still on the whole thing about immunity for telecommunications companies.
Yeah, Congress is at an impasse. They've been debating really for the last 2.5 years, but in particular since last August, what to do about immunity for the phone companies that took part in the NSA wiretapping program. The Senate has passed one version of a bill that the White House likes quite a bit that would include immunity for the phone companies. The House Democrats have refused to go along with that and have, in one rare instance, have stood up to the White House in the national security issue, which is unusual. The pattern for the last 2 years has been that the White House has essentially gotten its way on issues of national security, and the Democrats have been unwilling to risk being labeled, weak on national security and weak on terrorism. But in this case, for whatever reason and at whatever peril, they have resisted, and we're at an impasse still today.
We are going to check our weather forecast and then take your calls for Eric Lichtblau, who is the author of Bush's Law, The Remaking of American Justice. Eric won the Pulitzer Prize for his reporting on the NSA's warrantless wiretapping program. And he's in Madison today to talk about the whole story. And the title of his talk is How Much Does the Public Really Need to Know? 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. We welcome your thoughts and questions. I'm Joy Cardine. This is The Ideas Network. This is The Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. Glad to have you with us. Hope you stay tuned. Coming up this afternoon, it's At Issue with Ben Marins. And after 5 o'clock, Ben will talk with his guest about post-traumatic stress disorder and how it's affecting troops coming home from Iraq. That's coming up after 5 o'clock. After 6 o'clock, by the way, we'll have a special report from National Public Radio, a special report on the testimony before Congress today of General Petraeus and Ambassador Crocker. They'll be briefing lawmakers today on the situation in Iraq, and we'll have a recap of the day's events and testimony at 6 o'clock this evening here on the Ideas Network. Right now, we're welcoming your questions for Eric Lichtblau, who is the Washington correspondent for the New York Times. He is the author of the book Bush's Law, The Remaking of American Justice. He won the Pulitzer Prize in 2006 for his reporting on the NSA's warrantless wiretapping program. He's in Madison today. He'll be speaking at the Pyle Center at 2:30 this afternoon. That's on the UW-Madison campus. The Pyle Center is on Langdon Street, and there will be a book signing following his talk. How Much Does the Public Really Need to Know? A Reporter's Perspective on the Post-9/11 Age. And we go to the phones, and our first caller is Ray in Milwaukee. Hi, Ray, you're on the air.
Good morning, Joy, and to your guest.
Good morning.
I would like to first state one of our founding fathers who said, those who would give up liberty or security deserve neither. And then I'd like to point out the fact that every call going overseas during from 9/11 onwards, every call, not just to terrorists, but all of them, have been monitored, and every email has been monitored. The telecommunications workers that were involved with that, I read about them. Maybe it was the New York Times, an article other than the one you're speaking. But these workers were extremely angry, and I think even some of them had quit their jobs. But they said they are scooping up everything. Like my Italian friend who called his mother last week, his call was monitored. And that is why the telecommunications companies in this country want immunity, because they have sold us out to this phony war on terrorism. Mm-hmm.
Eric, how widespread was this? Is that
well,
right?
A couple of points. We certainly don't know that everything that the caller just said is true. I think what he's referring to with the telecom workers is the case of a single telecom employee, a former employee in San Francisco, a former technician at AT&T by the name of Mark Klein, who is now one of the main witnesses in one of these lawsuits that's pending against the telecoms. These lawsuits are now on hold while Congress is debating what to do about the immunity issue. Mr. Klein says that he was a witness to a much broader what could have been a much broader data mining operation, and we have reported about this separately. What Mr. Klein saw was the physical capability to get into to implant routers into the system at a plant in San Francisco that would have gone far beyond just eavesdropping on particular individual calls. The program that President Bush acknowledged after our story was a program specifically to listen in on phone calls and also read emails for the international communications of people who were suspected of having terrorist ties to Al-Qaeda. Now, it's all but certain that there was a much broader data mining program, which we wrote about very, very early on, just 2 weeks after our initial story in the Times. Jim and I also wrote about a much broader data mining operation to sift through enormous volumes of information without actually listening to those calls, not quite as the caller suggests, without actually eavesdropping on those calls, but to have computers going through and looking for doing essentially pattern analysis to identify what might be likely troublesome communications. This raises legal issues on its own, but we still, to be honest, do not have answers as to exactly what that operation entailed, just how broad it was. I think the caller is right to suggest that there was a broader operation, as we have reported. I don't think it goes quite as far as he is suggesting, though.
Yeah. So the law said, at least at the time, that the government could do this as long as a warrant was secured from a court that would, you know, some even could be applied for after the wiretapping began. But that was the the wrench in all this is that there was no warrant involved at all.
Right. A little bit of history here. Going back to 1978, after the abuses of Watergate, after the Church and Pike commissions had found all sorts of abuses in the 60s and 70s in terms of the use of intelligence to essentially spy on political opponents by Nixon and his predecessors, there were reforms put in place. There were safeguards that were enacted. One of the biggest among them was the creation of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act that created a special court, the FISA court, mm-hmm. it's known as, that required that all intelligence warrants, unlike a standard criminal warrant, if you think someone's involved in a murder or a rape or a robbery, that would be handled as a standard criminal warrant. But here you have a separate breed of intelligence warrants in the area of national security for terrorism or espionage generally, which everyone acknowledges is sort of a different animal. How do you treat those? That was the question. So Congress in 1978 set up a completely different system. It set up a court as a backstop, a secret court, which does not never operates in public, has issued a total of two public opinions in its history. It reviews the applications and the warrant requests by the government, and almost always signs off on them to determine who are the terrorism and espionage suspects that the government wants to wiretap. Thousands over the years. In this case, after 9/11, just weeks after 9/11, the president, at the urging of Vice President Cheney and his intelligence officials, decided essentially to circumvent the court and decided that when it came to international communications, emails and phone calls coming into and out of the United States, which intelligence officials say involve terrorism suspects, they would not go before the court. They would, on the president's own, what they believe was his constitutional authority as commander-in-chief, would simply make their own determination who was a terrorism suspect and begin wiretapping.
And that's what you call Bush's law.
That's certainly a big part of me. Mm-hmm. My book goes beyond, hopefully, just the NSA wiretapping. That's a big part of it. But you know, my book looks at the really the remarkable shift since 9/11, as I said earlier, a cataclysmic event, and the response to it by the White House, which was a radical remaking of the White House's view of the federal government's role and responsibility in how federal law enforcement and intelligence should work, and that applies to many different areas beyond just wiretapping law. It applies to obviously the what's going on at Guantanamo and interrogations. It applies to the roundups of illegal immigrants after 9/11 who were not shown to have any links to terrorism, but were held for months and sometimes years at a time without being charged. It applies to people who were essentially swept up in the pursuit of basically trying to find the next Muhammad Atta, trying to find the next terrorism suspect, and the basic thesis, or at least one of the main points of my book, is that this is not so much my judgment as the judgment of a lot of the administration officials who I interviewed for the book, 120 or so, is that the immediate response of the administration after 9/11 was in many ways perhaps not all that different than an Al Gore administration might have been had he been elected in 2000 or any other administration, that the country had just been through a horrific event and that the response was overdue and essential and necessary in many ways to avoid another 9/11. But that where people began to see the policy going off course was the failure to recognize a year or two after 9/11 that some short-term changes needed to be made. In other words, what I mean by that is that the country and the policy continued on a permanent state of emergency.
We're going to continue after we check news from National Public Radio with Eric Lischblau, who is author of the book Bush's Law. You're listening to the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine at 7:36, talking this hour with Eric Lischblau, who is the Washington correspondent for the New York Times. He is the winner of the 2006 Pulitzer Prize for National Reporting for his stories on the NSA's warrantless wiretapping program. He is also the author of the new book, Bush's Law, The Remaking of American Justice. Eric is in Madison today. He'll be speaking on the UW-Madison campus at the Pyle Center on Langdon Street at 2:30 this afternoon. His speech, his talk, How Much Does the Public Really Need to Know? A Reporter's Perspective on the Post-9/11 Age. And we're talking some about that during this hour, and you can join in at 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. And back to the phones, Jackie in Blue Mounds is next. Hi, Jackie.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Congratulations on the Pulitzer, Eric. That's a lot of work.
Thank you.
Michael, basically, I think the public doesn't need to know everything. But they do need to have confidence that their elected officials, their public officials, the judicial system is being operated constitutionally. I served 30 years ago in the British intelligence service, and you know, we've had our own problems with terrorism for 30 years or so in Northern Ireland, and we were able to keep support of the country from people in Ireland in the political system because everything we did was legal. And I think you can have secret and legal in harmony. And I think the huge distress we've had over this whole NSA situation was what else is going on that we don't know about, and we start asking many more questions than we would if we felt that, you know, people were operating constitutionally.
Mm-hmm. Well, I tend to agree with the caller's premise there, and what I try and lay out in the book is that, you know, the secrecy that obviously we see kind of manifested in the what we're not told publicly was also breeding a lot of suspicion within the administration. I try and tell the stories about all the tumult and angst within the administration over programs, not just the NSA program, but others that were where there was dissent over what people did not know. There was resistance to programs that was essentially shut down. People were discouraged from dissenting and were told, you don't need to know this. And when you have people with the top security clearance in the government not being able to find out key details about certain programs and having legal doubts about how things are being run, you can only imagine how that's going to play out in the public arena once these programs start leaking out, as they inevitably do.
Yeah, no, Eric, it's your job to investigate and report, and not necessarily, it's not your decision to publish, but you must have had some sort of feeling as to whether or not you thought that this story, the NSA story, would compromise national security?
I felt fairly strongly that this was a story that the paper could and should run, and I talk about that in the book. Mm-hmm. The fact that the U.S. government was targeting al-Qaeda through the NSA, was intercepting and eavesdropping communications, was in no way a secret. This had been advertised by President Bush and his top aides on down, that we are going to use every means in our arsenal, including what is called signals intelligence, to go after al-Qaeda. The secret here was the fact that the White House was not going through normal legal channels to do that, and we didn't draw, and I don't draw the conclusion as to whether or not that's legal or not. I'll leave that for your listeners. But that element of this did not, in any way, I don't believe, compromise national security. There were tougher calls. I did a major follow-up story about 6 months after the original NSA story, which talked about a banking surveillance program that was run by the CIA. Similar issues where the CIA was essentially trolling through huge volumes of international banking transactions by getting access through to a consortium in Belgium called SWIFT, which is the main clearinghouse for all things financial in the world. Basically, every major financial transaction goes through this clearinghouse. That raised, in my mind, a closer call as to whether or not that's a story that the paper should have run, and I think it raised a closer call in the editors' minds as well. And had it not been for this sort of raging debate going on at the time over the NSA story and the balance between national security and civil liberties, I think the paper might not have run that story.
Next, we go to Lauren in Delavan. Hi, Lauren.
Hi, Joy. Thank you very much for taking my call. This is a very, very sad topic for me. I mean, I think having our government spying on our conversations is absolutely dreadful. It's terrible. This is an illegal action, and I'm really, I can't find any justification for it. However, having somebody like your guest leveraging our state secrets for personal gain, I believe, is even more dreadful. I'm not sure which I'm more ashamed of at this point.
Well, I guess, Eric, we usually don't go for name calling.
Leveraging state secrets in what sense?
Well, I think that you're telling everybody in the world what our government is doing, gleefully digging up anything you can find, I think, is and doing it for personal gain. I mean, you've got your book, you've got your tour, you're happy, you get your notoriety, And I feel my family and I have lost something in this. I mean, I lost something from the government that's doing illegal spying, and then I've lost something from somebody like you taking our secrets and publishing them for your own gain.
Well,
I'm sorry about that.
I disagree with the notion that we publish, you know, whatever we find. As I discussed in the book, there are several instances where, you know, we have come across things that we believed should not be published, and we did not publish them because it was clear that the national security value, you know, outweighed the public's interest in hearing about them, and that's the role of a free press. This, you know, it's not a matter of personal gain; it's a matter of the First Amendment. And if you don't believe strongly in that, then I guess we disagree.
Yeah. Well, you must take some guff like this from time to time.
Is oh,
even,
sure.
even worse, seeing that
sure,
you're
all...
being traitorous. Or,
oh, sure, all the time.
Yeah. Well, let me take another call because we have others who are waiting. And our next caller is Daniel in Rice Lake. Hi, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hello.
Do you expect a congressional kickback, a reaction under the next administration under President Obama where the constitutional balance between the imperial presidency and the Congress is restored?
Well, you know, all three of the candidates who are still standing have pledged in some way or other to bring back the balance with congressional checks and things like that. Probably Obama has got the farthest of the three in doing that, and Hillary a bit less, and McCain a bit less. I think that the interesting question is whether once they get in the one of those three gets in the White House, whether or not the rhetoric will match the reality. I think it's one thing to say that you want Congress to be a co-equal branch of government, and that you're going to give back essentially the powers that your predecessor expanded for you. But it's another thing once you're in office to to relinquish those tools once you're faced with the next crisis. So I wouldn't predict how the next president will react, but I think that will be one of the major and sort of fascinating dramas of the next administration.
Thank you, Daniel. Tony in McHenry, Illinois. Hi.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I'm wondering if this whole conversation of investigation and monitoring of people's movements is really bigger than both President Bush and his father, in the sense that technology developed has allowed a government to monitor its people and its movements, and will history look back at 9/11 as anecdotal to the destiny that we were to be experiencing, that if it wasn't for 9/11, it would have been another incident that would have moved a country toward monitoring its people?
Well, I don't necessarily subscribe to that view. I believe that 9/11 was in fact a fairly unprecedented event. I know that there are certainly many on the left who believe that the administration, and Cheney in particular, was just sort of waiting for an excuse, if you will, to launch this view of an imperial presidency. I don't necessarily buy that. I'd acknowledge that there were some signs that the NSA was in fact already moving down the road to expand its role. There have been some reports that we have done and others have done about prior to 9/11 looking to do some operations more on the domestic side rather than its traditional role of the foreign side. But that said, I believe that 9/11, as cliched as it is, did in fact change everything, and that the response has been largely, if not entirely, as a result of that.
Our guest is Eric Lichtblau. He is author of the new book, Bush's Law, The Remaking of American Justice, which, among other things, recounts Eric's reporting of the NSA's warrantless wiretapping story, where the NSA was wiretapping phone calls between suspected terrorists abroad and people here in the U.S. without getting a court order. We are talking about the publication of this story and how the White House tried to stop it and how people were saying that this was compromising national security, but Eric and the New York Times disagreeing. Welcoming your thoughts and questions about this and related issues at 1-800-642-1234 in Madison 263-1890. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. Thanks for joining us on the Ideas Network. It's about 11 minutes before 8 o'clock on this Tuesday, April the 8th. We are talking with Eric Lichtblau, who received the 2006 Pulitzer Prize for his stories on the NSA's wiretapping program. He's a reporter for the New York Times, covering the Justice Department and national security issues since 2002. He's also the author of the new book, Bush's Law, The Remaking of American Justice. He will be giving a talk this afternoon at 2:30 at the Pyle Center on the UW-Madison campus. That's at 702 Langdon Street. The topic of his talk is how much does the public really need to know? And our next caller is Edith in Madison. Hi, Edith.
Yes, thank you, Joy. I am concerned about an issue that, to my knowledge, only one journalist, and that happens to be John Nichols of the Cap Times newspaper here in Madison, and that is the suspension of our constitutional rights in the amendments known as habeas corpus. I believe that we are still living under that situation where our rights have been abridged by John Ashcroft and by the subsequent justices of the Department of Justice who have not restored those rights. And I wonder if the data mining and the secret wiretapping and all of the rights that this president seems to have taken unto himself, if all of that could have taken place without our constitutional rights having been taken away from us.
Well, we at the New York Times and certainly other media have written extensively about the habeas corpus issue, so I'm not sure what the caller's referring to there, but particularly in reference to prisoners at Guantanamo, and this has been an ongoing issue with legislation in Congress and that at the White House is urging, did suspend the right to habeas corpus for foreign prisoners at Guantanamo and elsewhere. This has been a key issue, and it's part of this motif of how do you fight the war on terror? I mean, how far can you and should you go to stop the next attack? The White House's position has been that this is an extraordinary situation that requires extraordinary measures. There's obviously been some pushback, considerable pushback, the last few years from Congress and the courts and the public, for that matter. And it's unclear even now how some of this is going to play out, with the NSA wiretapping debate in Congress being the most vivid example of that because of the stalemate there.
Yeah. Thank you, Edith. Paul in Monona. Hi, you're on the air.
Hello. Thank you for your story, and I didn't hear all of it, but I wanted to ask you, I remember hearing Bush talk about the wiretapping program a very long time ago when it was first coming out, and he looked at the reporters and the American public and the Congress and said, you need a warrant to wiretap, implying that he either had one or wouldn't do it without a warrant. And I'm just wondering, there seems to be such reluctance, you know, of people to say that the administration lied to us, which I think is fairly clear, and I think the FISA court and the regulations are fairly clear, and they didn't follow it. You know, so I think they, you know, it's not a matter of debate whether they lied to us or whether they're doing something illegal. I think they did and are doing both.
Right.
And, you know, I'm just wondering, what is it that the administration still has over the press and Congress to come out and say that?
Yeah, the caller's referring to an episode before the program was disclosed in Buffalo in 2004 during the debate over the Patriot Act, when the president very emphatically said that whenever you hear about wiretapping, a court order is required. And I talk about that at some length in my book. I mean, this was, I would argue, and I do argue in the book, part of a campaign of active concealment to prevent disclosure of the NSA wiretapping program, because it was only just a few months before that public speech by President Bush that he had faced a revolt from his own Justice Department over this program, with the Deputy Attorney General and more than a dozen senior officials, including John Ashcroft, ironically, threatening to resign over this now famous scene at John Ashcroft's hospital bedside, where Alberto Gonzalez and Andy Card had visited Ashcroft's bedside to try and get him post-surgery to certify to the legality of the program, even though his deputy and several of his lawyers had questioned whether or not this program was illegal. So this was a critical period in 2004 that I discuss in the book, and I think it was part of an effort by the White House to keep the lid on the program.
Yeah. Next we go to David in Appleton. Hi, David.
Hi there. Perfect segue into my question.
Mm-hmm.
As you said, the Deputy Attorney General Comey. It's my understanding that he was describing, that mutiny which resulted in an alteration of the original domestic surveillance. Do we know much of what the full extent of that program was prior to what was altered? It's my understanding what the altered program that came out of that mutiny was in part what you described in your famous piece back in December of 2005.
Yeah, we know some, but not enough. I mean, that's one of the unanswered questions, that Congress and others should still be investigating. We believe that part of the program before that episode was called into question was a broader data mining operation, and that as a result of some of the legal concerns that were raised during the mutiny, as you call it, and I disclose in my book that several aspects of the data mining operation were ended in March of 2004 as a result of this. There's still a lot more to be known, though, about that episode.
Yeah.
Do we know to what extent the FBI was involved? Given, Glenn Greenwald has observed that the centrality of Director Mueller in that whole famous hospital episode, he was trying to infer from that perhaps the FBI was involved in the domestic aspect of this. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, the FBI was certainly involved, and I've reported to the extent that it was the consumer of the NSA's information, meaning that what the NSA was getting was quickly turned over to the NSA to follow up with, to chase down these leads, and it produced a flood of leads for the NSA for the FBI. That were, for the most part, dead ends. These became known at the FBI as the Pizza Hut leads, because in the sort of 6 degrees of separation of finding out who called who and who called who and who that person called, the joke at the FBI was that it often led to the Pizza Hut delivery guy, and that the NSA leads were more often than not worthless. So the FBI was a consumer of this information, and early on, especially in 2001 and 2002, there was a feeling that it was chasing its tail in trying to run down the leads that the NSA was giving it.
Yeah. And Jeremy in Rice Lake, is it Jeremy?
Wrightstown.
Oh, Wrightstown. Okay, go ahead.
I just wanted to make the point, as a 14-year member of the U.S. military, the Army, I was a military linguist and served most of the time with the National Security Agency. And I just think it's important. One of the things your guest mentioned before was the concern about top secret clearance holders not having access to information. I just want to make it clear that, it's important to share information with the public, but compartmentalization exists for a reason. And then Robert Hansen and the espionage he committed is a perfect example of that. So I did get out of the military and out of that career field because I do think our freedoms have been eroded, and I don't believe in that we should be doing that. But at the same time, I think it's important to protect our national security assets as well and strike a balance, because I think the pendulum swings both ways.
Yeah, and we only have 30 seconds. I would think you would agree that there's a balance, Eric?
Sure, absolutely. But there, and with 30 seconds, I can't really respond in depth, but there are a couple episodes I talk about in the book where the failure to take to include senior people and let them know about what was going on really had a really damaging effect on operations and almost brought things to a standstill.
Well, people can read more about it in Bush's Law. Thanks a lot for being with us.
Oh, a pleasure. Yeah. Thank you very much.
Eric Lichtblau is the author of Bush's Law, The Remaking of American Justice. He's in Madison today. You can, if you're here, see him at 2:30 at the Pyle Center on the UW-Madison campus. Thanks to Carmen Jackson and Karen Prager for producing the hour. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.